everybody. This is Polly. Josh is on the line.
Hello, everyone.
Okay. I think it's exactly 5 o'clock. We're going to get started. You know that we do these calls twice a month. We do the first Thursday of the month at 12 o'clock Pacific and the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Pacific. And if you have a question, just star 2 and we'll find you. And I'm looking for my control page right now. Oh, it disappeared when I started the recording. Okay, so I'll be able to see everybody. All right, Josh, are you ready to go?
I am.
Okay. Well, I will just start with, sometimes these are long, but of course they're in a lot of pain, so they're trying to explain as short as possible. I just got a divorce, have a young son, and am living in part of my parents' house. I can't work because of my panic attack and anxiety. My parents are retired, and they would like me to get a job and gather myself. I just can't. My son also asks me when I'm going to go back to where I was before and be more there for him, and I say, I don't know. I'm very frustrated with my life right now. I wish I could function with no medication. I wish I could be positive and be a good mother and do what normal people do, but I can't. My family, all except my parents, don't understand my condition, and they don't like me. They think I just don't want to be with them, that I'm faking my condition. I feel really alone and a burden to my parents and a disappointment to my son. I'm really tired because I have had this condition 33 years of my life. It started when I was 2 years old. I'm sorry, everyone, for trying to encourage when I can't even encourage myself. Is there any hope for me?
Yeah, there is. You know, both my mom and I can relate to being in similar places. It feels odd, actually, for me to sit here, being the supposed expert and answering questions and relating intimately to where this person's at. There's almost, well, there really is too much in that question to go over all of it in this format. There's just a couple things I would start off with. I think that as devastating a disorder as anxiety is, we do know enough to fix everyone. I think that there's pieces of the puzzle all over the place, and I try to be sort of a central hub where people can find all those different pieces. I think that one of the missing pieces when I first began struggling with anxiety was what my parents ended up putting together, the nutritional side of things. I think that was the last piece of the puzzle. That's not to say I don't think new pieces of the puzzle will come into place as time goes on. We might get better therapies and all different fronts. We will get better knowledge about this. But I think enough is in place now. To her aloneness, you know, I get that all the time. And I would say that there is millions of people in America alone, if that's what she's writing from. We get calls and write-ins from all over the world. So wherever she is, there are millions of people all around you struggling in as difficult a situation as you find yourself in. It's unfortunate that she's in a family where she believes no one understands. I have been surprised when I have shared with people my own struggles, how many people I find in my world, how many people I'm kind of naturally drawn to who have struggled just like I have. And this was at a time when I didn't think that it was common at all. And when I open up like that, I'm always surprised what I hear, whether it's people in the struggling with cancer or alcohol addiction or drug addiction or infidelity. I hear all kinds of stories of people struggling deeply. If you think you're alone with this disorder, maybe your immediate family doesn't share this exact thing, but people who tend to respond the way families responding, by isolating her and not really relating to her, they have their secrets. I'll tell you that they have their struggles, and I'm sorry they're not willing to be open to them. But I get people who call from this sort of place of desperation. And part of that desperation is having a son, having an obligation a situation that forces them to function at some level. And I actually am encouraged by that. When people cannot stop, that's just not an option. They tend to do better more quickly. You know, right now she's seeing that as a burden. It won't be viewed that way. You know, if she moves forward, that power will be meaningful. That sense that right now, again, of being forced is a negative, but in time it will. Of all the people that I talk to, sometimes you know you'd think I wouldn't bet on a person with such a difficult starting point. But actually, I bet on this person more than most as far as how quickly she can grow from here. There's something also of desperation, obviously, in this question. And that's when we get open to real change, real lasting change. I know for myself, I wasn't. I was always of the opinion I could fix this myself somehow. And it wasn't until I was in a similar place where I really began to reach out. And she's reaching out, but she's already doing that first step. So that's, you know, a very complicated, meandering answer. Yes, there's hope. Absolutely. Not only is there hope, but there's reason for encouragement. I hear, as awful as that starting point is, that is a powerful place to begin. And I work with people just like this and see these people turn things around. And boy, are they appreciative of every step on the way out. And it's a real part of the joy of my job.
Yeah, I remember being at that point with my little children and it just being so terrible and not wanting to let them down. And, of course, you don't want to give up because you've got somebody dependent on you. One of the things that I would direct her to, we finally, I think, have the bugs out of this. It was pretty terrible for a while, technically speaking. We have a webinar, the Fearless Live More webinar available, and I'm going to give the address. It's www.breakfreefromanxiety.com/3-secrets-opt-in/. So that's the spelling is Break Free From Anxiety, the same as our website, .com/3-secrets, secrets-opt-in/. So if she puts her name in there, she's going to get the 3 secrets. And right away, we've changed it so that they get all of the webinar at one time, and they can jump around, they can go through, although it isn't in order. So they get the whole thing at one time. She can listen to it, and she is just going to be so surprised at what she's going to learn. And I need to get back to my control page because I had to find that for you guys. Okay, so the next question. Feeling very achy tonight, bad back pain due to reducing diazepam. I still feel like I'm being forced off it by my doctors. Oh, by the way, I looked up diazepam so we don't make a mistake on which drug that is. That's Valium or Valrelease.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
But main thing, I didn't leave myself short this month. Pick up script tomorrow. Going to ask for a hold in reduction. Bet I don't get it. Also been reading other people struggle with diazepam online, so you don't feel alone. Also see this on a site and found it interesting. Going to show my doc tomorrow. Laugh out loud. Hope everyone else is keeping positive. I'm trying.
Well, diazepam, you know, it has a lot of muscular relaxation component to it. Our bodies get used to what we do, what we ingest. I feel like going on a little complicated discussion about opponent process theory, but
what's opponent process theory?
Okay, opponent process theory. Thank you. Opponent process theory is the idea that when we introduce something that swings us away from normal, our body is creating an opposite effect. you know, drugs only work in our body because there's a site for them to be received by. There's many things we could take that would have absolutely no impact on us. The drugs we choose to take work because they trigger a site that our body produces a chemical to trigger on its own. Does that make sense?
I guess so. Okay.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's like a lock and key thing.
Right.
The keys wouldn't work unless the body already had the locks. The locks wouldn't be there unless the body was already making keys that looked identical. So when we smoke nicotine, that's not exactly a copy of dopamine, but it's close enough of a key to trigger dopamine response.
People love to smoke.
Yeah, it just is this random alkaloid chemical in the world. It's actually designed to be an insecticide that the plant naturally produces. That's why tobacco really only has one insect that eats it. It just coincidentally mimics almost exactly a key that our body produces naturally. And so it turns the lock. Not all of them, but it turns enough of them for us to get a high off of it and develop addiction. What is addiction, really? When we flood our body with these keys, whatever it is, in this case it's Valium, diazepam, over time our body tries to swing itself back into balance. And when we remove all those keys flooding our body, now our body's kind of built to be balanced with that excess. And whatever the drug does, we're likely to see the opposite effect on the way out. So without those locks being turned anymore, our muscles might not work as well. They might be more prone to spasming, fatigue, contraction, the same things that Valium does, but in opposite. Now I'm going to go off the scientific spectrum. Yes, you have dogs. And probably a visitor.
I'm trying to... sorry. Yes, someone drove in the driveway. Go ahead and talk, and I'll be right back.
All right. And so what's important to know about this, so that's the scientific explanation. It's pretty well established in psychology. It's still called a theory, but the way we understand how drugs work, how tolerance develops over time. Now, one of the surprises is, and I'm in this category, I don't share this very often, but I take a very small dose of a benzodiazepine. That's the class of drugs that include Valium. I take a different one, but I've taken it at the same dose for, 15 years, 13 years. I'm kind of it's in that neighborhood, certainly well past the time where people would expect to see tolerance. What the textbook is supposed to say is that I am supposed to need a little bit more drug as the years that go on. And maybe if I up my dose a little bit, I won't see much effect. If I drop my dose, I'll see huge consequences. And that doesn't seem to be the case. I remember talking to a pharmacist a long time ago, and he said, you know, people who just come in and use Valium, use Xanax, use Klonopin, and they don't really need it, those are the people who get tolerant very quickly. People who struggle with generalized anxiety and take a drug just to get close to normal, and I'm in that category. I'm not even trying to feel completely calm. I'm just trying to feel close to normal. That opponent process theory, maybe it's working exactly how you'd expect. If anxiety is me out of alignment and I use something to bring me a little bit closer to alignment, not that I'm swinging myself all the way over to the other side and having this wonderful, relaxing evening simply because I took medication. Maybe addiction is different in that situation. Now, again, there isn't scientific literature to back this theory up, but I can tell you from my clinical experience, when people take medication just to feel close to normal, these tolerances are much slower to develop, if at all. That doesn't mean that you can just rapidly pull the drug away and all of a sudden they're back to normal. You will develop some level of addiction. That's inherent in this process. But the textbook, I don't think, would agree that I should be able to stay on a medication for as long as I have and not need an increase in dose. So if we think about opponent process theory, maybe swinging yourself a little bit towards the middle but not beyond really doesn't create the kind of addiction issues we're used to. But in this particular question's case, you lower a medication that's been relaxing your muscles, whether you're aware of it or not. Valium is very good at that. much more so than Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, much more like the other side of the benzodiazepines that focus on body relaxation, so like Soma. Soma is really only issued for muscle relaxation, and it's in the same category. So within this drug category, we get two groups, basically. One side works with body, and the other side works with, let's call it, mind. And then we get drugs like Valium that are kind of in the middle. They're the older drugs that expose people to the idea that benzodiazepines could do both. So perfectly normal to experience the muscle tension, even for people reducing in that one anti-anxiety side, the mind side, even when people reduce that, you can see some muscle-body type effects. That's pretty normal. And I think doctors should be really on top of this. And I really hope that they, you know, as long as I have somebody, if they want to reduce their dose and they're just doing it, and they're choosing to do that, if they take a month, 6 months, a year, 2 years, I just want to see them succeed with the least amount of trauma possible. I don't feel the need to.
Yeah, we don't need to feel any worse than we already do. One of the things that stuck out to me was that we address, nutritionally, we address some of the muscle issues with the nutrients that we use in the Break Free program. So I'm wondering if she's going to have a lot more muscle pain than other people coming off of Valium, because she never got to the root cause, and she's still deficient in those nutrients that are forced out by people, by the chemistry that the people like us have.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, yeah, you've heard me say everything about my job gets easier when people are on the Break Free program, and that's true. And I wasn't thinking about it in this answer, but the specific nutrients we see will absolutely address this kind of muscular response, for sure.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, since they never address the root cause, if her, you know, response may be way greater, because she's been going through years probably of not filling those depleted nutrients. And so, of course, her muscles are going to just really start spasming up. And this has been falsely, I guess it's falsely not the right word, forcing her muscles to relax in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, it's been serving as a it's a nice
kind of
thing.
Overriding
actually.
The system that we have in
yeah.
place normally to make our muscles contract and relax.
Yeah,
correct?
there is a natural system there, and taking Valium isn't part of that natural system. There are dietary elements that can create a natural equilibrium where our muscles aren't designed to naturally do this. If they're doing that, something went wrong. She's somebody who could benefit tremendously from the Break Free program.
Okay. This one is kind of a fun question. I got this yesterday. This guy wants to know, why do I shake when I feel scared? People say he's anxious and they don't want to be around me. They're scared of me because they think like I'm having a seizure or something. I'm worried about losing my job. There's two distinct issues here. One
sure.
is why does he shake, and the other is about losing their job. So you want to go ahead and start with that?
So the why we shake one isn't 100%, as far as I know, understood. I can certainly take a stab at it, and it's certainly something that I struggle with personally. When I was young, you know, for me, I always felt like it wasn't fair. I got hit with this very young, and all that chemistry, you know, hitting a 5-year-old body, a 6-year-old body, you know, a little, you know, what, 55-pound thing, it was pretty intense. And what I remember is that, these waves of shaking. And I could restrain them, kind of, but any time I kind of relaxed, my teeth would chatter and my whole body would shake. What that sure sounds like, you know, when we talk about a panic attack, we're dealing with three chemicals predominantly, cortisol, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. Epinephrine is just a scientific way of saying adrenaline. So you can easily, anytime you hear epinephrine, feel free to substitute adrenaline in your mind if that's a word you're more used to. And I know that, you know, there's the way these chemicals are reacting, it's funny, it's that same lock and key model, except these these keys are doing different things. And one thing I feel like clarifying, it's not part of the question, but it was something I struggled with as a child. You know, people would tell me that, adrenaline, epinephrine, causes your blood vessels to constrict so that you don't, when you get cut in your hands, that's why they're whiter and they feel colder and maybe numb. So you won't bleed. And your face gets white, and that's, you know, so you can get cut and it won't bleed. And then someone else later would tell me, oh, it's a vasodilator, so that your big muscles get all this great blood flow so you can run away quickly. And I thought, well, what is it? You know, does adrenaline make my vessels larger or smaller? And the answer is, the body's designed so that the same key can do different things in different places. It depends, kind of, if you will, how the door is designed. The key fits in the lock opens in the door, but what happens at that point is up to the local area. And
isn't
so
that amazing?
It really is.
When you learn
hours.
That, it's just like, oh my gosh, this is such an incredible body. It's such an incredible system. I loved studying this. It was just so exciting to me.
Questions. I know. Everyone asking these questions kind of has some level of hatred for the fight or flight response at this point. Part of my job, learning about this, really kind of changed my image. The way I look at my own anxiety. I see this system as just an amazing system that just would work beautifully and does work beautifully in actual life or death situations, of which I've been in some and I've performed beautifully. However, you know, when we live in this world, it gets a little, you know, and I kind of always say with freeways and elevators and Starbucks and all the stuff that it's unique to this
modern
world.
Yeah, the news, the internet.
There's just a million reasons to make this system run awry.
I was listening to the news this morning, not because I wanted to, but because my nephew was listening to it, and it was just, I bet while I was standing there were 10 horrific tragedies from all over the world, and we wouldn't have heard about those.
Sure.
You know, maybe one in 3 months or something we'd hear about. But it was the earthquake in Tibet, and it was the helicopter going down and killing the crew, and it was—I mean, it just went on, and I just had to walk away.
So give yourself permission to walk away, not just
I
you,
am.
But anybody listening. You know, we were designed. I always think about my body as being designed for about 10,000 years ago, and when we see those images, you know, if we saw that image that was happening to us, to our clan, to our local area, and it was a threat, we're supposed to respond to that stuff. And it's our brains are not designed to see 10 tragedies in a row and be able to comprehend that we live in a 7 billion people world and understand that that's perfectly normal and safe. That's distance and that's not, you know, in my backyard. Okay, let's wind back to this question.
Yeah, the question we diverted ourselves from.
this beautiful system, when it's going awry, it's pushing and pulling blood all over the place. And I think the shaking comes from, as the sensors that are used to nice warm blood flowing, that blood isn't flowing there anymore, and your body naturally wants to warm itself up. And it's going to respond just like you're cold. Because where those sensors are, you are cold. And then in your core, you're nice and warm. But that shaking is just part of the reaction. It's an absolutely normal part of the chemistry. Not everyone responds to shaking. I'm one of them.
I'm one of them, too.
I don't get it at all. So it's normal.
I've always thought that the shaking had a lot to do with using up the energy that you have because you release all that glycogen in your body and you're, you know, prepared to lift a car off somebody. And you're sitting there trying to act normal. And I think the body has to dissipate it in some way. We pee a lot, we poop a lot, we sweat a lot, we breathe hard. You know, it's getting the toxins out. But I think shaking actually, it's kind of like a form of exercising.
Sure.
It doesn't feel like
it
because your mind is pointing inward at the shaking. So you're like, I'm so afraid, and you're shaking. But I think the body is actually trying to dissipate this huge overload of chemistry that you have in your body.
Yeah, again, I haven't read a really good paper that described that phenomenon. But, yeah, what we would expect is, as my mom was pointing out, your body just goes into this mode where it's converting every sugar it can find into ATP is what it's ultimately going to be going after, the actual cellular energy, adenosine triphosphate, and you're just going to have these absolute surplus quantities of energy. Not good for marathon running, very good for about 2 minutes of absolute full tilt running. I was just working with someone today and explaining to me, there are studies on this. You can take somebody, and if you really put them into a fight or flight state, they'll run for about 2 minutes. Anybody at any level of fitness with the right fight or flight response, you can run as hard as you want for 2 minutes, and then we're all going to hit a wall. And that's because in nature, in 2 minutes, it's over one way or the other. That's as far as the system needed to get you. Probably in 45 seconds, the situation dealt with one way or the other. If you chose to run, you either got away or you didn't. If you chose to fight, the fight is over one way or the other. So, anyways, we're kind of going off on this.
Yeah,
tangents.
Okay, so this actually, I realize, has three parts.
Yeah.
Pardon?
So the second component of this question was the shame element.
Yes.
That people will see me and see this. And, yeah, there's an unavoidable, whether it's, you know, gastrointestinal or sweating or flush, there's going to be something that we can't hide about this. The shocking thing is, for as awful as you feel on the inside, how good you can be at hiding. And I can tell you there's a tension generated there when you feel as though there will be consequences to being found out and you're choosing to present an image that's radically different from the way you feel. There's a cost to that.
He's saying that they have noticed it. And I suggested to him that he tell them why. Because I found, well, hiding it, for one thing, just makes it worse. But then when I tell people what it is, they're not afraid of it. Like, you know how people react when someone has a seizure?
Sure.
It scares them, and mm-hmm. they want to run, they want to hide, they don't want to get near the person because they don't understand. I remember catching a lady as she went into a seizure, but it didn't scare me, you know, because that just isn't something that scares me. But nonetheless, for most
it
is very scary. It's like a surprise. They've never seen it before. And so they have that reaction. So I find that just telling people what it is, why you're acting this way or why you might act this way, relieves them and you. So they go, oh, I can't catch it. It's not going to happen to me.
Sure.
Or they say, oh, gosh, I know exactly what you're talking about, and only I think I'm going to have a heart attack, or I can't breathe, or I can't swallow. So you're going to get some people that understand. You're going to get people that now aren't afraid of you. And then the final part of the question was about he's afraid about losing his job. And it turned out, in the conversation, that he works for quite a large company, and I'm not sure if I directed him to the right department. I said to go to HR and tell them that you have an issue. It's a handicap, and Dr. Myers used to write prescriptions or excuses, I guess they would be called, like school release excuses or work
right.
excuses. And so we had a patient, as an example, we had a patient who had migraines, worked for a very big company. And the company, of course, got tired of him having migraines, calling in and saying that he couldn't come in because he had a migraine. But legally, they have to honor his disability. And so my husband would write a report or a release, and once he did that, then the company had to allow more absences and more leeway. They couldn't fire him for not coming to work because he had a headache or a migraine. So there are some government rules that are in place that it wouldn't be a one-person office, you know, a one- or two-person office who couldn't function at all if you didn't show up. But many of the larger companies are obligated under some handicap rules, and I don't have the names for them, to accommodate the handicap. So do you have anything else to add to that question?
Well, I usually encourage people to at least pick a person that they haven't talked to it about yet, that they feel a little bit uneasy talking to it about, about it too. But not, you don't go straight to the head honcho, the person you're kind of terrified of. You just, what I encourage people to do is take notes of all the catastrophic thoughts that come up. You know, if I tell this person X, Y, and Z is going to happen, and then go through with it and then see what actually happens. And this is just a first lesson in challenging our catastrophic thinking. It's noticing the difference between what we think will happen and what actually ends up happening. So I'll leave it there. We could go on and on any of these
questions.
I know. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
Okay. New question. I need advice. My anxiety and depression have started a terrible cycle. I'm a prisoner to my anxiety and feel trapped. The more trapped I feel, the more depressed I get. The more depressed I get, the more I need to break free because more anxiety about being trapped. I have friends on Facebook, but for the most part, I don't hang out or see anyone. I work from home, so that eliminates even more chance of interaction. I'm scared, sad, and lonely. I'm 36 and have been fighting this my whole life, but this is as isolated as I've ever been, and I don't know how to make a change or start meeting people. The thought of doing anything alone scares me, except to shop, but I think it's because I'm so focused on what I need, or maybe it's because I've always had to do it alone. I'm exhausted all the time and can barely make myself do the things that have to get done.
Yeah, it's funny. This is like the opposite of the first question about being shoved in a family that doesn't understand me and a sense of isolation. But here's a person who has every opportunity to isolate themselves. And there's an assumption, I think, by the first questioner that if they got to live this life, no kid, no obligation, you know, a work that I didn't need to challenge my anxiety, that everything would be lovely. And that's just not how this works. We eventually need to challenge our anxiety directly. And in some ways, this question, this person, it takes kind of more of a personal character to force themselves to challenge something that they kind of don't have to. But in this case, they've identified things that they see they need to work on. It's the same game, I'll tell you that. We pick a goal, we watch how our anxiety tries to keep us from accomplishing it, and, you know, I work with people doing this every day, and that first goal, I don't know what it would be, I'd have to talk to this person and pick that first thing. I think intuitively we do know what a step in the right direction would look like, and that might be going to a public gathering of some kind, giving yourself an opportunity. Generally speaking, we're social creatures, and we do need some level of support network, and we get great value in that. One of the things that holds people back in this process is the assumption that they've got to go from point A to point Z, and that, you know, that they've got to go from where they are all the way to, you know, this complete life, with, and that's just an insurmountable goal. And I can tell you one of the fun things about anxiety is the costs are all up front. Whatever that first goal turns out to be, everything you do during that, I always call it making my rubber stamp. The first thing you do that really challenges your anxiety where you step out into the world is hard. But every feature of that is no more difficult than any other step along the way. So a person, let me think back to maybe my very first client, a person going on a 20-minute bus ride, now that might be incredibly difficult to begin, but down the road, it's the exact same game to get on a 6-hour plane ride, and I remember watching people go through this process, and so the rubber stamp imagery there is, it's really hard to make a rubber stamp by hand the first time. You have to carve everything out, and, you know, you have to you have to carve the mold, and it takes forever. But once you've made that stamp, it's rather easy to dip it in ink again and repeat the process. And that's what getting over this feels like. So focus on some manageable goal. that probably induces anxiety. You know, I've said it not on this call, but the longer you struggle with anxiety, the more likely depression is to show up. And, yeah, you can get trapped in a cycle. I've been in pretty much that exact cycle between depression and anxiety. And there's something about a certain level of desperation that allows you to take a risk and take that first step. A lot easier to do with help, a lot easier to do with support. And then, yeah, I hope I'm communicating this well. The first step is the hardest, and there's nothing magical about steps 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, all the way down the road. Once you've done the process once and gotten through adding a new feature to your life and making that normal, adding another one is the same game, and it gets actually easier each time, even though the goals might be much larger. So I'll leave that there. I hope that's enough.
The part, I'm exhausted all the time and can barely make myself do things that have to get done. Anxiety absolutely uses up tons and tons of energy.
Sure.
I mean, we are, as I was saying before, we get the chemistry and the sugar, the fuel, the ATP that you're talking about, to lift up a car, to rip something apart, to beat something up, to run really fast. And we get it, instead of for 2 minutes, we get it for hours and days and weeks and months. So we're just completely running out of gas. I mean, there's just nothing left to draw on. So anxiety is extremely exhausting. I had someone who finally broke down and took some medication. I said, you've got to break this cycle. And she goes, I can't, because when I take this stuff, this medication, it makes me sleep and sleep and sleep. And I said, because you are so exhausted. Your body is so exhausted. It needs the time to sleep and make all these repairs that, you know, it hasn't had a chance to do, and clean house and do all those things. So it's not surprising that this person is extremely exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen people who started on the program. I've seen people the very first day. Now, it's not, I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, but I've seen them very first day sleep all night.
Right.
And they're just like, oh, wow. And that makes tomorrow so much easier.
Right.
Than when you're without your sleep. It's very, very hard to function when you're so exhausted and tackled.
Yeah, I think when people come to me, they often assume that we're going to jump right into working, and that's true for some people. I will, you know, make a homework plan for that week, and we'll get to work. But for people who kind of sound like this question, I might spend a week, 2 weeks, a month. I call it restoring their battery. And where I say, look, we're just not going to work on that. You're so depleted. We're going to sleep. We're going to eat right. We're going to, you know, tamp down some of the thinking patterns. And we're just going to give ourselves permission to recover.
Yeah.
You know, in many cases, I'm talking to people where this is, you know, year 15, year 30. And I'm not going to just simply say, okay, time to get in that car, go to the store.
Right.
Right.
Get on
yeah,
the bus,
airplane. Yeah, that would be inappropriate. I'm going to say, okay, here's where we're at. And here's where we're headed, and here's what it looks like along the way. Here's how we can watch ourselves recover. And sometimes just giving people permission to not just push, to actually take that break for themselves. Many of the questions, including the very first question this night, included this sense of selfishness. Like, I feel so selfish.
I know. I hear that. They want.
Yeah.
They're the mothers, particularly, like, or the wage earner, and they're just feeling they just have to push and have to push and have to push. And they never give themselves permission to take a break.
What I always point out to people is that if you take this break, yes, it kind of feels selfish. What you're able to give back to people might be 10 times what you're able to give them right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can keep going at this low level where you're just barely hanging on and give everything you have. But in fact, that oddly enough is the selfish thing to do. It doesn't feel like it, but in fact, taking some time out is the most selfless thing to do in the big picture. And, a number of people I have to sit down and explain that taking time for yourself gives you so much more ability to give back to others, loved ones, the world, that it's worth doing, and it's anything but selfish.
It's hard for them to do it, though. They're just,
absolutely,
this group of people in particular have a real hard time not taking care of other people. Not everybody. Some are totally selfish, I have to say. Run into
it does
a few
happen.
Of those who it's me all the time. But in general, you know, 95% of the time it's, I can't stop. I've got to take care of so-and-so. I can't let people down. Pretty responsible people.
Yesterday I saw a movie and there was someone crunching popcorn annoyingly. And I, you know, could have gotten up and moved a couple seats. And I just, that old pattern of what will these people think, you know, that arose again, you know, that idea of being noticed, judged, whatever, not disturbed, you know. We take our, for many of us, we take this to an extreme. And we might sit there and suffer rather than do some really simple things to feel much, much better, that the reality is no one cares. I've noticed that in the world, you know, when you get up and move, I don't care. I don't take it personally if someone moves a couple feet in a movie theater or makes me get out of the way so they can go to the bathroom. But we tend to push this on ourselves, like these are these dramatic events that need to be avoided. And this is part of the personality that often goes with anxiety, which, going back to the worker question, makes us incredibly wonderful employees, generally speaking, even with our drawbacks. You know, maybe we miss a few more days, or maybe we're not ideal at every meeting, but just, you know, incredible loyalty, intelligence, compassion, all the things that tend to come with this package, generally speaking, make us much better employees than say, average or normal people.
Absolutely. Okay,
right.
Here's a totally different, we're going to go
good.
On. Well, it isn't different than it is. Of course, if it's about anxiety, it's always going to be somewhat similar. But this one really threw me when it came in. I have anxiety. I was just diagnosed with cancer.
Okay.
I don't know how I'm going to make it to my appointments, sitting through chemo and not being able to leave. Please give me some tips. I really want to live, but I also want to hide. Thank you.
So, you know, I've never been through cancer.
No, but I've sat with my sister going through chemo for hours. You know, you sit there and the drip goes in and you just have to sit there for hours and you've got an IV in, so you're really stuck.
Yeah, I know. I certainly understand the concerns she brings up. It's somewhat similar to when women talk about getting pregnant and just being terrified of this committed process that, you know, how will I be able to do all the things I need to do? And lo and behold, everybody gets through. I'm not going to say that each step along the way is easy, but I can say that when there's that much purpose in play, we have this magical ability. And this, you'll see this somewhere. When you have to do something, you do it. And I swear you can switch the anxiety off. There is just some level of purpose that when it arises, for me, it's if a friend's in need. That's not going to say that's not saying I feel zero anxiety. But I don't feel as much, or I don't feel as lost, or I don't feel as devastated by it. I still feel very functional. And we get through. You know, you like to bring up the Holocaust survivor thing, that people who struggle with anxiety tended to do better in the death camps. And that wouldn't make, that's not surviving a moment. That, you know, this isn't your typical fight or flight response where you're just trying to survive the next minute. You know, we're talking years of threat and people dying and starvation and all that stuff. And to know that people who struggle with generalized anxiety actually did better overall, you know, that's very telling. That when our purpose drive, you know, our that survival, that when that elevates to a certain level, we do what we need to do. You know, I can recall dozens of incidents in my own life when someone was dying and I just had to get on an airplane and go deal, or someone died, family needed me. There's this ability we have to go do what needs to get done. I see that over and over again, not just in my own life, but in the people I work with. was talking to a woman today, and I asked about that. She had something come up, and she needed to function. And I said, did you notice how your anxiety was able to be put to the side when you needed it to be? And she absolutely said yes. So, yeah, this is definitely going outside the realm of, you know, like we're going to find scientific studies on, but I've seen it too much for it to be just a coincidence.
But, too, she can follow the rules of telling people. She can explain to the nurse that's doing the IV. She can talk to her doctor. She can, I'm sure they see a lot of anxious people, and they probably have medications that can help you. These people tend to sleep a lot once they're going through chemo because it tends to be so rough on the body. I know my sister ended up just sleeping 80% of the time she was sitting in the chair. So, but just telling people is going to help her. Just telling those people. There's a group. There'll be a group that she'll know. And just right off the bat, telling the nurses or whoever, this is the way it is. And so I need you to blah, 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 whatever. She can unhook from the porch, I suppose, and stop if she was really freaking out, but they'd probably just come over and just give her an injection of something to make her relax. So actually with that IV going, it'd probably be pretty easy if she really freaked out. So pardon?
It sounds like the worst situation in the world, but when you're sitting there amongst people, caregivers and others struggling at this profound level, you know, it's hard for people to maintain kind of that external facade anymore. It's a place, I think, of automatic honesty. Not always. I'm sure there's people who keep a certain image even though their hair's falling out. But oddly enough, it might actually be a place where anxiety is lower, where we can be candid, whether it's with our sadness, with our fear. Everything will be a little more out in the open.
She could grow tremendously from this, actually.
Yeah, I'd be open to that. It doesn't quite relate, but I intentionally put myself in situations where people are afraid. I do all kinds of flying sports and extreme stuff. And, you know, it just puts me in a place where everyone's scared. And all of a sudden my feelings feel normal and I tend to perform better than everyone else. And if you've endured any anxiety going through a chronic challenge like cancer treatment, you might find that you're the star, sort of. You're the one who handles the ups and downs better than everyone around you, and people might even lean on you, ask you questions about what it's like to how do you manage things like that.
Being able to help others when she goes through it.
Yeah, I wouldn't view this as some sort of death sentence in the sense of like that this is an unsolvable problem. Like this is the worst thing that could happen as far as, you know, you're just going to be pummeled by anxiety and there's nothing you can do about it. I wouldn't approach that at all. I'd encourage her to keep a really open mind as to how well she might actually do. Prepare to be surprised. I end up saying that to a lot of people, but in this case, be prepared to be a little surprised at how well you might do.
Yeah, we've been doing this a long time. She might go through the chemo better than anybody else.
Right.
Okay. An old habit of constantly checking my pulse to see if my heart is too fast or if it really is skipping beats has just resurfaced. It drives me mad and makes my anxiety worse. My heart is always beating faster than I would like and makes me worry more. Any tips on how to get out of this cycle? It's not as easy as just stop checking my pulse as I can't. A little OCD there. So.
Yeah. I mean, we all have some level of OCD kind of inherent in this. This is one of those cases where we're trying to understand. People think often, I was definitely in this camp, that if they come to some understanding about some element of their anxiety, they'll beat it. If I can fix my heart, my anxiety will go away. And they're kind of going backwards. If you fix your anxiety, this pattern of behavior will go away. I was talking to someone today that struggles with this heart rate thing. It's and you can ask all kinds of questions. There's a funny paradox here that I'd like to point out that most people with anxiety can relate to. And it goes something like this. When you have this cycle of noticing a physical symptom and you associate it with anxiety, it causes anxiety, but you're thinking it might be proof that, what, an impending heart attack, I have some neurological condition, something like that. If that is the cycle you're in, whatever it is you come up with, I have a heart issue, I have, we go all over the board. It isn't that. It almost by definition isn't that. It is, it's a hard thing to explain. The closest I can come right now is my kids always come to me, when they fall down, like, do you think I broke my shin, my toe, my finger? And I look and I kind of put on my doctor hat and I kind of go, no, and here's why. And it's so funny, when my son finally broke his arm, the first child in our family to actually break an arm, came to me, he walks through the door, and his hand is shaking. There's lots of things. I've broken many a limb. And I can see a little angular shift in his wrist, and I go, did you break that? Just happened like 30 seconds ago. And he's like, oh, no, it's not broken. and that's the actual break. And so I've worked with so many people, and they actually have many real conditions. I've worked with people with everything from psoriasis to actually having MS. And they're fine with that. They've gone through the acceptance process, and not that they're completely at peace with it, but it isn't part of their anxiety cycle. And literally everything everyone has ever come up with as far as, oh, here's a symptom, it must be this, and that's part of their anxiety cycle, out of, what am I doing this, 13 years now, 14 years now, zero have ever come true.
That's good.
And so when I look at, an elevated heart rate, I go, well, that's right in line with what we would expect to see with the chemicals that our body's naturally producing. And, I'm a push it guy. I actually, ride bikes up big hills and push my heart rate to its actual maximum. And it's funny, it's this number that just slowly drops as I get older. Right now it's right around probably 190. Which is pretty fast, right? 190 mm-hmm. beats per minute. But, towards the top of a multi-mile hill climb, I'll probably be touching that. I'm usually doing a climb trying to do it as fast as possible. And I don't mind if in the last 10% or 5% of the climb I hit that 100% heart rate as I'm kind of not. You don't want to do it the whole climb. You just won't climb as fast. You'll burn yourself out. But it's like our body has this natural governor, just like a car would, where it just literally will not let us go past. And it's a protection mechanism built in. And it adjusts itself down as I grow older. And I just love the idea that my body has built-in protection. When someone's taking their pulse and it feels a little elevated, usually they're in 80 beats per minute, 90 beats per minute, maybe. And to know that I can safely go up to 190 beats per minute and that my body has this natural protection mechanism gives me a lot of trust that I'm safe. The only way I can force my body to go into that dangerous land beyond 190 beats per minute would be to, cocaine would do it. And so there's ways, but no, if we leave our body alone, no matter how much adrenaline, no matter what we go through, our body has this mechanism that limits us, keeps us safe for a reason. I always point out to people that the fight or flight response wouldn't be a very good response if it killed you. So this thing we fear doesn't induce these kind of, death. We kind of have this myth in our society, like, oh, the secretary, when the house got robbed, when the business got robbed, she died of a heart attack. Well, if that ever actually happened, which I'm sure it has, she didn't die of the fear. She had an issue, and that was the little tipping right there, that extra adrenaline. Cause the blockage. Our heart doesn't just stop running because there's some adrenaline going through it. Again, that would be a very bad response if that's how our body responded to the fight or flight, the survival mechanism. It is definitely not designed to kill you. So in that rare instance where people have the artifact, it's because there's a big chunk of plaque nearby, and it finally got moved by the accelerated heart rate of the event, and it caused the heart attack. That was many a bag of Cheeto that led to that moment, or some jeans, or yeah, that wasn't the anxiety that did that. So to everyone out there, you know, like it or not, anxiety cannot kill you. Honestly, Mom, it can make your life miserable much later in life, but actually kill you is pretty unlikely.
Yeah, it'll be something else from the free radical damage or something. But back to the question, I know what this person is afraid. She has the heart issue, but I felt the heart issue, and of course I have a heart history, so I've always had to be aware of that. But when I get in a stressful situation and when I get depleted enough, I will feel every beat of my heart, and I will feel it flutter and flip and compensate, and it does all kinds of things. But as soon as I give my heart the nutrients that it needs to make that muscle function correctly, it goes away. It takes a few days for me to fill it back up, but it will go away. So there's two different things. The one is the racing heart because of the chemistry, and then there's the other one that's the erratic heart and the pounding heart that you feel each beat, and that's from it just not having the nutrition that it needs to do its job well. So it's kind of just doing the best it can, and it kind of skips and blips and flips and does strange things. But it's really easy to fix, really easy to fix.
Yeah, I'm always surprised. And without it, though, people can struggle with the same thing for years. And just go through this cycle where they obsess on a symptom, that symptom persists, the anxiety sticks around, the anxiety keeps them depleted, the symptom persists, and the anxiety persists. It's funny from my point of view. I've been both. I've been stuck in the cycle, and now I counsel people on how to get out of the cycle. And you're never as far away as you think. You can feel really stuck, really off the path, really distant from wellness. And from my point of view, I'm like, oh, no, we get this in place, that in place, and maybe usually with most people, it's no more than five changes in their life. And all of a sudden, that cycle just breaks. And then growth begins. It's I have a very fun job.
I love it too. It's really fun to help people feel good again. My history is that I had rheumatic fever and was in the hospital for a year. So my heart actually filled my entire chest cavity. I was supposed to die. It was very severely damaged. And we've worked on it until it's been repaired. And so when I have issues, I always have to take a look and say, well, is there anything? Well, when I go in, I have a perfect EKG and almost a perfect echocardiogram. So,
I just want to let everyone know that my mom, you know, has had doctors accuse her of lying about her medical history. She's done such a good job in nutritionally repairing herself that you've been accused of lying. And I know your history, and I know it really happened. So.
I know it. It used to make my mother so mad when I say that the doctor said I couldn't possibly have had rheumatic fever. And she said, well, they weren't there, and the seven doctors that were there, and we're spending the night with you as every breath waiting for you to die, and your chest, we could see it on x-ray, was he, you know, filled your whole cavity and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I went through like 18 years of follow-up care, and then my husband became a doctor, and we learned how to heal, give the body what it needs to heal itself. This was prior to dealing with the anxiety disorder, and by golly, my heart just started picking itself up and putting it back together, and it just was amazing to watch it do that. And today, I just, yes, people have accused me of not of faking it, that this history is not true. But that has nothing to do with the anxiety issue, that I know what they're talking about, and that in a few days, even with the highest stress that I can have, like the death, I've had a couple deaths this year, and actually more than a few things, and I'll feel it start flipping around and flopping and race, it'll race a bit, and then it'll stop, and it'll, and you know, and I go, oh gosh, listen to what it's saying. Go in there, take your stuff. You've got to compensate. And even with the tremendous amount of stress that I've had, it 4 days usually within that, it, I've got it cleared up. So it's just talking to me. So we are at the end of the time. It is 6:01 p.m. And I will post this up on the internet, and people will get to listen to it. Keep sending your questions. We love to have them. And when we have people that are brave enough to get on, we will talk live to you. But it's okay. We understand that anxiety tends to make this group much more reluctant to be on the telephone. And now Josh and I have a hard time stopping talking. Joshua's goal is to speak to at least 1,000 people at a time, which is interesting because, you know, you wanted to be in your hidey hole for a while. Now you can't. It's very exciting for you to think about talking to those people.
Yeah, it is very much.
I know.
I just want to let you know, I've gotten some very positive feedback. Yes, people don't tend to jump in during these calls, but people on their own time tend to listen to the recordings, and I've got a number of people that really, you know, got good information, and they're really happy with those.
I know. I get some nice little notes, too, but they just don't want to jump in. Okay, so I'm off to fix dinner. And thank you, and it's lovely talking with you every week. Or no, every two weeks anyway. It's fun. I love helping.
Yeah, I enjoy
people.
It as well. I enjoy being a part of this process. I
know.
I really do.
It's wonderful. Wonderful group of people. Okay, sweetie. Bye.
All right. Thanks.
And bye, everybody.
Bye, the moderator has left the conference.